Hello everyone, welcome to our fourth installment of Polititeen. Today it's June 8th, 2020, and Damien and I are excited to present to you our best episode yet, discussing things like defunding the police and how race relations and race riots have unfolded in America today. And as always, stay tuned to the end of our podcast for any updates and, you know, feedback from Damien and I. Thank you so much for your viewership, and we hope you enjoy today's episode.
Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the fourth installment of Polititeen. I am your host, Damien Galvin, joined alongside Varun.
Hey guys, welcome to our fourth installment of Polititeen podcast. It is June 8th and it is currently 10:30 p.m. in Atlanta, streaming live from Atlanta. And the focus of today's podcast, if you don't know, is going to be mainly about defunding the police and how cries like these from protesters have really taken off within our nation with regard to protests like these. But Damien and I will be talking about many, many, many issues on a nationwide and worldwide level today. Just an introduction to Polititeen. Our podcast is mainly to kind of draw a light towards the issues that we face today from the perspective of two teenagers from Georgia and the perspective of social media and social media phenomenons.
Obviously some housekeeping. We want to thank you guys for all the support on the petition. It's doing absolutely amazing, and it's exceeding our expectations. Me and Varun are very thankful for that.
Yeah, we're at 2,500 responses over now. So it's absolutely insane the amount of community support that we've received for our petition. And keep gunning it out. Keep fighting for Forsyth County to expel the students involved in the racially insensitive acts we talked about in the last podcast.
Yeah, you want to just hop into this episode, Varun?
Yeah, for sure. So the main focus of today's podcast I'm going to introduce head on is defunding the police. And we received many, many, many indications of these protests going in the direction of defunding the police. There's many, many standpoints on defunding the police as an initiative, but just to define it for all of our viewers, defunding the police is not, you know, taking all the funds the police have to completely net zero. Right. Defunding the police is rearranging the funds to where, you know, we focus on different things that are more specific to cities, for example, drug control teams and things like that. So how are your opinions on the defunding the police movement, Damien?
Well, I think that I'm going to start off by saying that I think it's a horrible name for a movement because it gives the complete wrong message right away. Like defunding the police, most people, when they listen to that, they're definitely going to think that you're defunding the police entirely. However, I disagree with it. I think that we should overfund the police. I think that the issue is the job that we're giving the police. I mean, we're expecting them to solve every single situation that comes our way. You know, if a dog is loose, we call the police. If we're speeding, the police are the ones that pull us over, and they're dealing with everything from catching dogs to you know, solving murders or being on the scene of murders. I think that they're being overworked, and I think that they're being underpaid. So in my opinion, I think that it's not a question of defunding the police. It's a question of how do we fund these other things and fund the police even more, or if the police are using their funds adequately. Because I think that it's not right how little police officers are being paid and the burden that they have.
I agree and disagree in some capacity, Damien. I think I agree in the point that what Biden mentioned earlier today and earlier in the week about defunding the police. Biden actually said, and as a nominee for the Democratic Party that's projected, he said that defunding the police is not the way simply because we need to invest in things like police reform, first of all, and things like rubber bullets and things like body cams, which are very expensive, and they also create accountability, per se, for the police and are kind of methods of non-lethal approaches to incidents like these. So in that sense, I do agree that defunding the police is not the way. But in a certain sense, with certain situations, I actually do agree with that controversial standpoint. For example, the NYPD, if you don't know, is actually given $6 billion as their budget cap every single year, which is more money the GDP of 50 nations combined and more money than WHO budget right now. So I think that the amount of money put into that force can be better placed in other initiatives and like things like the health department in the city of New York and the city of New York. I think that overfunding this department is actually a problem in these places like that. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you see, I didn't. On average, I didn't know that they were being paid $6 billion, but on average, the NYPD per year and other big city police departments are giving $1 billion in in what do you call it? The damn, why can't I can't think of the name here. Lawsuits. They give away $1 billion in lawsuits because of the way that police officers handle themselves. So my question is, instead of putting $1 billion in lawsuits for police misconduct and police, in cases like these where they murder African American men, or they murder community members, and they have to give away $1 billion. That's a huge sum of money. Would we make it possible that police earn a higher pay, and that the police that are coming in are being trained well? That's why I'm saying that we can't underfund these police. We need to learn nationwide. We need to do an investigation on how each police force is spending their money and how they're budgeting themselves, because I think that the vast majority of it should go into police training. But another thing that I think is that these police officers should be paid a lot more, and that if you're going to be doing more training, it goes hand in hand. If you're going to be training more, you should be getting paid more. So I think that it's ridiculous that they're spending over $1 billion in lawsuits on average. I think that they can use that money better, once again, to pay their police officers and to train their police officers to avoid paying that $1 billion. What do you think, Bruin?
I think we're using the money in the absolutely wrong way because looking at current anti-bias training and programs to kind of make police officers less biased and racist towards people and their actions, I think we're wasting money because we're looking at studies, and I'm looking at studies online, and none of them are effective. Looking at the numbers of people actually getting affected by police brutality increase after these anti-bias programs are implemented, which shows to many police officers are actually getting counter. They're counterproductive. They're kind of resisting these programs and going on to do more police brutality. But in a sense, I think that I think a rise in police pay is one thing, but also investing in things like non-lethal force, rubber bullets, and other than training, ways to kind of control things and mitigate things without a show of, fatal brutality is essential in terms of funding. And in terms of defunding, yes, Damien, I believe we should transfer funds from certain segments that aren't really applicable to every single city and to segments like training, anti-bias training, right anti-bias training.
Well, yeah, I agree with you, and I think that the point that you're making is good, but I don't think that defunding the police is the correct term here. I think that we need to refund the police. If anything, we need to remanage the way that they're being funded, and we need to make sure that these police officers aren't, in a sense, being that the training that they're going through isn't counterproductive. Because, as you were saying, I kind of misunderstood your point there, but were you saying that police, when they go through the training, when they go through the bias training, it actually increases their amount of brutality? Is that what you were saying?
Right, so it's being counterproductive because what I'm seeing online is that these officers are not following the rules of anti-bias training, right? But they're going against it because they're kind of, I don't know what the word I need to say here is, but they don't want to follow those rules, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, okay, I get what you're saying. That was just a weird point, because I wasn't really catching what you were saying. I wasn't sure if you were saying that the police are counterproductive or if the training is counterproductive. But I don't
Yeah.
think necessarily that the training is counterproductive. I think that they're just being counter-trained, because you have you're having police forces that are being trained in anti-bias training. But I'm not sure if you saw the recent video circulating, where you also have police officers being trained that if they're not ready to get in the mindset of killing, then they shouldn't be police officers. So you have two methods of training here, and obviously it's not necessarily about just African American brutality, and it's not just necessarily about a bias training. It's just these people go through. This is one of the most stressful jobs, and in years that we've seen that they've been more militarized. Since the early 2000s, or since the beginning of the 2000s, you've had the police becoming more and more militarized, which is why you see sometimes their budgets increase. We were talking about the fact that riot control gear is 10 times as expensive as PPE. However, we had all this riot control gear on standby, and I think that that's a product of overfunding and mismanaging the budget that these police corporations are being given by the government and by the taxpayers. So I think that we just need to be more open, and that we need to kind of rebuild the way that that were doing policing. And you know, I'm not just, you know, speaking out of thin air here. I don't know if you've seen what's happening in New Jersey. Are you aware?
I am not. Elaborate on that for me.
So in New Jersey, after the killing of an unarmed black woman, I believe, they fired all of their police officers and rehired all of their police officers. So all of their police officers had to go through a rehiring phase, and they kind of rebuilt the way that their whole police system was training. They remanaged their funds, they retrained their police officers, and they actually saw police brutality rates going staggering low, like numbers that we don't even see imaginable at the point that we're in right here. So I think that we don't need to defund the police. I think that that's going to create hostility for police. Again, these people are overworked. I mean, they don't see their family. When they pull up to a car, you have to wonder, you know, you have tinted windows, you have music blasting. They have to wonder, is this the last time? Was the morning that they woke up the last time that they're going to see their family? And they're doing it for what? I don't know how much police are paid, but I can tell you that they're being underpaid. And it doesn't just start with necessarily police. I think teachers are also being underpaid, and certain government employees are being underpaid, and other government employees are being overpaid. So it's a difficult situation, but I don't think that defunding the police is necessarily the answer.
I think I disagree. I disagree because defunding the police, simply what we're talking about here is the $6 billion is in the New York Police Department's, funds are not going towards paying the police, going towards arming the police and training programs for the police and community regathering programs. I think seeing defunding is not going to see a decrease in the pay of the police per se. It's going to see a decrease in the amount of money put towards specific efforts, the refunding of that money to different efforts. So the pay of police is not really of the utmost importance in defunding the police. It's more of how much money is put towards certain initiatives when compared to other initiatives. For example, riot control gear, plastic bullets and things like that.
Yeah, okay, so I see. You're saying that we should pay the police more and use the and because from what I'm understanding, you're saying that riot control gear and the militarization of police is more expensive than if we just gave them a significant pay raise.
Yeah, the pay raise is not really the question here. It's about things like rubber bullets, the militarization of the police for sure.
Yeah, and I think that you know, militarization is a weird term. We definitely have seen it increase, but you again, people in certain circumstances, you know, it's a stressful job, but unfortunately, there was a quote being said that I heard what our research director mentioned at a protest. She said something along the lines of someone told her the police isn't failing. The police officers, the police system isn't failing. It's just doing what it's meant to do, and that's oppress minorities. And that's an interesting way to look at it. On that topic, you think right now is a good point to bring in the clip that I was talking to you about, Varun?
I think so, but first I want to mention just one other talking point on tagging along to the point that we're talking about defunding the police. I think that 8% of all male homicides are committed in the U.S. by police. We're looking at rights groups and the family of George Floyd calling for a UN inquiry into American policing. And 650 activist groups and people have just called for a UN inquiry by sending a letter to them. And you don't know, Trump did withdraw from the U.S. from the UN Human Rights Council. So them looking into
Wow.
our misdemeanors in this is absolutely insane. Because a few years ago, Damien, we were the people pushing forth human rights violations against other countries.
Yeah,
Them coming
yeah.
back and looking at us is absolutely insane. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, some people might say that it's unnecessary and that we aren't violating human rights, but I mean, that's what other countries would say when we would, you know, inquire into and question their human rights abuse. So it's an interesting situation for sure. I'm upset that I wasn't aware that we left the UN human rights section. That's
Did.
disappointing. That's really disappointing because, you know, we spent most of the 19th century building ourselves up as being a leader in the world, and now we're kind of dropping that very quickly. I don't know if that's necessarily Trump to blame. I don't know if a UN inquiry into U.S. politics is necessarily the best thing at this time. I'd have to do more research on that. But with that being said, I think that we should play this clip
Sure.
from Kimberly Jones. I don't think that just the audio does it justice, ladies and gentlemen. I think that you really have to watch the clip itself and see her expressions. It's very empowering. So here you go.
So when they say, why do you burn down the community? Why do you burn down your own neighborhood? It's not ours. We don't own anything.
I don't hear anything right now, Damien.
We don't own anything.
Okay,
there is, Trevor Noah said it so beautifully last night.
So I think that it's only going to play for the podcast. I can't fix that currently, but the podcast viewers can hear it.
Yeah, awesome.
There's a social contract that we all have that if you steal or if I steal, then the person who is the authority comes in and they fix the situation. But the person who fixes the situation is killing us. So the social contract is broken. And if the social contract is broken, why the fuck do I give a shit about burning the fucking Football Hall of Fame, about burning a fucking Target? You broke the contract when you killed us in the streets and didn't give a fuck. You broke the contract when for 400 years we played your game and built your wealth. You broke the contract when we built our wealth again on our own by our bootstraps in Tulsa and you dropped bombs on us. When we built it in Rosewood and you came in and you slaughtered us. You broke the contract, so fuck your Target. Fuck your Hall of Fame. As far as I'm concerned, they could burn this bitch to the ground. And it still wouldn't be enough. And they are lucky that what black people are looking for is equality and not revenge.
You know, it's... every time that I listen to that message, it really gives me chills. You can really hear the pain in her voice. It's such a powerful message, and it really brings a different aspect onto what we're looking at here. I mean, you know, she says at the end, and this is the part that really, really, you know, shakes me to my core. She says at the end, they better be happy that we're looking for equality and not revenge. And you know, that statement is just so powerful, you know, because if they were looking for revenge, you know, what would be happening here? You know, I think Frederick Douglass said it the best, and I talk about Frederick Douglass a lot, but he said, when the white people took the desire for Africans to become slaves, they didn't just dehumanize the Africans, right? Now African Americans in later years, but they didn't just dehumanize the slaves. Slowly but surely, they dehumanized themselves. What are your thoughts on the fact that I'm just lost for words here. It's so empowering to see what she's saying and to say the fact that, you know, you built their wealth, and when you finally decide, you have Booker T. Washington, you have early people in the 1900s who are trying to build their wealth for the black community, for the African American community, and then you see it once again systematically oppressed. What are your thoughts, Varun?
I think it is, what she is saying is completely in support of looting, and not in support of looting, but in support of, you know, not pushing down the narrative of racism in favor of pushing forth the narrative of looting, if you get what I'm saying. Because a lot of news channels today have been completely shunning what these BLM Black Lives Matter protesters have been saying in favor of just talking about looting. And we should really mention what systemic racism really is. And that's what she's been communicating within her statement. And I think it's a very powerful message, like you said. And it's a message that we as Americans all need to hear. Know that this thing has been going on for so many years, and as you know, the police department it began as a means of just controlling slaves.
Yeah,
it's the first policing forces we had, and even as we go on, it has been completely to control our African American population in the early days of the police departments across the nation. So I think mentioning that history and mentioning how we've progressed and how we haven't progressed is important for all of us as Americans.
Yeah, it's necessary to remember that the reason that we are here is because we wanted it. We got here. You know, one thing that's, you know, I talk about paying the police more. Earlier in the podcast, I was talking about the fact that we can't defund them because we got to pay them more. You gotta remember that you have police, right, working because they need to make a living in areas where you have poor people, typically African Americans, because of the systemic oppression that has happened, that has endured. You have to remember this decision. Any time that white people start to move into areas where African Americans live, I forget the term for it, but anytime that they start to move into areas where African American lives, then the value of the houses in those communities go up because of the whole push to only have white tenants in the 1900s. You know, that's just an example of systemic racism. But beyond that, you have these people that are being forced to live kind of where the white man wants them to live. If the white man needed them as a sharecropper, which they had them for years after slavery ended, which was another form of slavery, you know, they had to pay a debt to the white man. And it's just insane to think about the fact that, you know, white people can make the decision, and I'm not just talking about white people, you know, wealthy people can make the decision to move into areas where unwealthy people, typically African Americans, that's why I'm using these terms here, and minorities like Hispanics live, and they can just push them out. You know, when it's the white people and they want to live in the cities, they tell the black people to get out. When the white people want to move back to the suburbs, they tell the black people to get out. And it's been that way, and it still is that way.
It's a historic form of white privilege, Damien. I think it's seeping into the form of white privilege that we see in our nation in many, many, many sectors. And I think that going forward into that, we should talk about how the Democrats have tried to kind of control the protests and control the fears across our nation about racism, systemic, and in the police departments across the nation. They haven't really called for defunding the police on a nationwide scale, but they have. Earlier today, they did announce a sweeping reform bill to increase the kind of regulations that we have on the police. Actually, their bill was, I don't know the exact text of it, but as a summary, they wanted to curtail existing legal protections that should, you know, shield officers against legal prosecution, right? And then also increase new restrictions to prevent law enforcement from using deadly force in all encounters. And I think that it is a needed set of regulations that falls in line with the 8 steps that people have defined on Twitter, kind of regulating the police. How do you feel about Democrats pushing the regulation of the police on a congressional level?
I think, you know, Democrats, they're doing a good thing, but you have to wonder why now, you know? Why now? Why are they doing it as a publicity stunt? You know, in the 1930s, you saw the switch from African vote going, you saw the African American vote going from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party because of the switch in ideals. So do you think that the Democratic Party is just trying to maintain their vote by making this push? Because you have to remember, these people have been in power for years and years and years, and they now decide. And it's not the first time that an African American has been killed. It's not. And it more than likely won't be the last time that an African American is unjustly killed. So why are they deciding to do it now?
I think, Damien, that, you know, people are protesting, and we have thousands and thousands of people on the streets protesting across our nation for this, and it really has opened up their minds and shown them that people care about this issue, and also, obviously, that they can get their vote by pushing forth reforms like this. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's a difference between two parties, right? The Republican Party focusing upon looting and incidents like these. The Democratic Party is focusing upon reforming the police, which I don't care if it's now or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I think that the fact that they're doing it instead of staying put, doing nothing, does say something about the party itself. Doesn't matter if it's for the re-election campaign. I honestly could care less about the motive. I think that what they're doing is valiant.
You know, I don't necessarily know. I think that we're going to have to see. We're going to have to see if this is just going to be if this is just going to be a push, if this is going to be a one-time thing, or if they're really going to start to push for change. Because, you know, you saw the whole civil rights movement end, and you saw these Democratic leaders in the 60s that were pushing, you know, for civil rights and stuff, and it ended, and they got the civil rights, and they just stopped caring about the black community because they thought that they had their vote. So are they trying to reassure their vote? I don't know. We're really going to have to see how that goes. But I think that it's unfair to say that the Republican Party is just focusing on looting. I don't know if you saw, but Mitt Romney actually went out and he was protesting. What are your thoughts on it?
I think Mitt Romney, I'm talking about the Republican Party on a kind of generalized scale. I think that Mitt Romney is more of a centrist Republican and more of a Republican who doesn't agree with those policies that many of them are pushing forth in the news or on Fox News and things like that. I think I respect Mitt Romney in 100% doing what he did that day, and you know, for protesting and in solidarity with the protesters there. I think he made a statement, because having our president talking about how protests are ranting about issues that aren't really of importance, and having a Republican senator go out and say, you know, I stand with these people, I think it's powerful.
Yeah. So I think, you know, he made the statement, Black Lives Matter. He made the statement, Black Lives Matter, and you wonder, why can't the president just come out and say, I agree, Black Lives do matter, and just kind of put an end and try to unify in this time, instead of, you know, saying that we need more militarization and we need more riot control and that we need to control the streets. Why doesn't he just come out and just make both statements? I mean, I would be a little bit more content if he would come out and make both statements and say, you know, African Americans are Americans too, and they need to be treated that way. And even if they are being treated that way, and he disagrees with that statement, it's a statement that needs to be made for unification, and it's a statement that's necessary right now. What do you think the Democrats' response to that statement would be? Do you think that they would say that he's just trying to appeal to the black vote? Because I could definitely see that being said, that he's just doing it to appeal to the black vote. It feels almost, you know, I don't agree with Trump's politics, but it feels like now anything that he's doing, whether it's right or wrong, they're looking at the bad side of it. What do you think?
I don't think so. My standpoint. I think that if he says that and comes out and says Black Lives Matter, not gonna ignore it. Say it's gonna be national news that he wants to call for unification, but they're gonna take a look at his past statements. For example, at the Rose Garden speech that he made at the White House, it's like, and I'm gonna quote it directly, he was saying something around the fact that, you know, George would be proud of the economic gains that we've made ever since his death. I think that having rhetoric like that, as Biden said, George Floyd's last words were, I can't breathe. Putting any words in George Floyd's mouth is completely, completely diminutive of his death, of how he died. I think that having him saying things like that and saying things like, and retweeting Candace Owens' tweet that George Floyd should not be held as a martyr, he is not a martyr whatsoever, is contradictory. They're not going to call him on saying it for approval, but they're going to call him on the fact that he's being contradictory.
Yeah, you know, I was looking more into the whole George Floyd dying as a martyr thing, and you know, I know that we discussed that last time on the podcast, but the whole looking into if he was a worthy martyr or not, then brought up the question about Breonna Taylor, and I wasn't aware of how amazing she was. You know, she volunteered at hospitals during times of the pandemic, and she would always do volunteer work, and I wasn't aware necessarily the circumstances surrounding her death. The wrong house was raided, and the man that was supposed to be raided was arrested earlier that day. And she, you know, it's just such an unfortunate situation, but how come no one brings up the fact that she was the perfect martyr? How come they always only want to look at the bad thing that the black man does when he dies? You know, I don't think that it's fair. I think that regardless of what you think, that this was a death that could have been prevented. I don't care if they're Hispanic. I don't care if they're Latino. I don't care if they're Asian. I don't care if they're white. in America, no one should die that way.
I was going to say, along your point, it doesn't matter their race, their ethnicity. It doesn't matter if they're a rapist, if they're a criminal or anything like that. What matters is that America, the country, has devoted itself to upholding due process and our laws above everything else.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting situation. Now, another, I guess, on the same topic, but a little bit of a turnaround. So, I'm not sure of the fact. Well, actually, before we mention that topic, we're going to cut to an ad here. For our live viewers, you're not going to get it, but for anyone listening in post, here it is. All right, we're back. I wanted to talk about the fact that. Both Obama and Bush's administration had above 12 inquiries done by the DOJ into different police organizations across the country. However, Trump's administration, and this isn't their first term, both the Bush and the Trump administration, or Bush and Obama administration, yeah, were in their first term, just to make that clear. We're not, you know, saying in two terms, which would be completely unfair to Donald Trump because he's only served one. In their first terms of each president, they had, I think it was 13 and 14 police investigations done, or investigations by the DOJ done into different police organizations across the country. But in the Obama administration, we've only had one. So it's a very stark contrast. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you meant to say the Trump administration only had one instance.
They did have one instance.
Okay, you said Obama, so I was just clarifying that.
Okay, sorry.
Awesome, you're good. Anyway, so I think along your point, I think that that's why people in many organizations, and George Floyd's family, his brother and his son, are calling for the UN to inquire on behalf of the U.S. Okay. into police brutality in our nation, because we haven't been getting that, our president and our administration, and I think that people are just deprived, you know, that kind of second inquiry and accountability held to police officers, because no matter how good our reform efforts are in the police department, our regulation efforts, we have to also maintain a nationwide level of accountability. Thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I think accountability is good. I think that we definitely need to maintain that accountability, and that we need to hold our police accountable, and that our police need to hold us accountable. I think that that's the only fair way that it's going to operate. I don't know necessarily. I don't have all the answers on proceeding forward. I think that we definitely need to rebuild the way that police are trained, and we need to switch away from the militarization of police, and we need to not even just manage the funds of how the police are doing or managing their funds. We need to also wonder what other organizations are mismanaging their funds, and where can we put those funds to more adequately serve the American population.
That's, you know, the mission of refunding police departments. I'm not going to refer to it as defunding this podcast, because I think it really does not, you know, show what the goal of defunding the police actually is. I'm going to refer to it as refunding the police. That's what the goal of it is. You know, digressing from the point of police brutality and race, because that's been the focus of our podcast for the past couple of episodes, I wanted to mention, Damien, the coronavirus.
Okay.
You know, and how states are opening back up. How do you feel about New York City opening back up after 3 months of being closed?
You know, I feel like it's so delayed. It really is. Now, coronavirus has been one of the interesting ordeals, I would rather reword this, is the fact that we thought coronavirus was going to be a lot more lethal than it is, and we took extremely conservative measures in the terms of what we were doing for coronavirus. I think that we flattened the curve, and that's the important thing. That we need to proceed with opening a lot more quickly. I don't think that it's fair that these small business owners, you know, you talk about the fact that, again, I mentioned this for the second time consecutively in a podcast, you had you have the Republicans complaining about the fact that small businesses are being burned down to the ground and that people are losing everything they work for. Yet 40% of small businesses said that because the Republicans declined giving more money to them in the $4 trillion resolution for coronavirus, the relief bill, that they would have to close down. So 40% of small businesses had to close down because of that. And you have to not only, I mean, these are people's whole lives. And it's very tragic. And I don't think that it's fair. I think that we also. I think that we need to open a lot quicker. We need to open up quickly because people aren't just dying of coronavirus. They're dying of something that can affect anyone of any age. And it's not just because of necessarily job loss, but they're dying of suicide. I mean, the suicide rates have gone up a lot since the start of this pandemic. What are your thoughts?
Disagree in terms of opening back up quicker than New York City has opened back up. Because I sent you a link yesterday, looking at how they have structured their guidelines on the regional unpause dashboard of New York, we have seen that there's seven requirements that New York City's had to kind of go through before they reopened. And NYC was obviously the last place to reopen because of how many cases were received and continued to be received by them. But you know, the regulations were including 30% hospital and ICU beds to be available, you know, for people to kind of demand, and 30 out of every 1,000 residents should be tested monthly. I think that these kind of regulations are important for our nation to follow before reopening, because as you know, as true it is, the coronavirus is not a lethal infection for a bunch of people. I think that opening back up with caution and specific to how a region's handling the virus is very, very important. And the other thing I wanted to talk about in terms of small businesses, Damien, was the fact that, you know, in New York City and places like this, we're trying to reopen small businesses, but most of them are not reopening because of something else. That's not the virus, but that is protests. How do you feel about that? Protests and looting not allowing for the reopening of small businesses.
Well, again, I think, you know, it's a difficult situation. As a centrist, you look at both what the Republicans are saying and what the Democrats are saying, and you don't see any resolutions here. I think that, again, people, you know, I mentioned this on our first episode of the podcast that we're tired of being treated as pawns, but I feel again that people are even in the Democratic Party are treating minorities as pawns. It's especially in the Democratic Party right now, they're being treated as pawns, and they're using coronavirus as a pawn, and it's all this stuff that's going wrong. And it's again, I mention it every episode. It's not just in the Republican Party; it's in the Democratic Party. A lot of the blame and a lot of the shift by a lot of media right now is going towards the Republican Party. But you have to think about the fact that the Democratic Party, again, they offered their first resolution only today, and obviously, I think the correct pronunciation. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know if you know, but they wore the Cantu scarves, and it's just it goes. It's kind of similar. I saw some correlations being made to Donald Trump's photo op in front of the church holding the Bible. Do you think that that's just the those judgments are being made, those correlations?
I have to say no, because they sat down and they kneeled for 8 minutes and 46 seconds in respect to George Floyd. Now, before making their kind of resolutions towards stopping the protests that are happening by regulating police, and I think the reason they did that is not as much getting the African American vote, it is stopping the protests or crippling the nation. In terms of small businesses, because these protesters are not going to stop in a day with no action being drawn out. And we're seeing tear gassing by the president that is just making the protest more and more and more heavy. And I think the only way to appease these protesters, Damien, is through resolutions like that. In terms of a photo op that they were doing, I think there is some comparison made, but Trump's photo op involved tear gassing protesters to
Okay.
get them out of the way. And
I
it involved him holding a Bible outside of a church. And making nuns stand outside, not perform their usual activities. So I think they're not disturbing anybody. Simply, it may be a ploy for power, maybe a ploy for power, but they're also showing respects to George Floyd.
Yeah, okay. I see what you're saying there. I saw the photo op comparison being made and the whole Cantu scarf thing being used as a prop and stuff. But that was before I was aware of the fact that they were doing this I think it was it after they proposed a resolution for police control? It was right. Okay, so it was before they proposed it. I wasn't aware. So obviously, you know, it's not just a photo op, because afterwards they went and they gave their side of the story. Now, I think that we need to kind of get away from this whole Democrat-Republican kind of debate, and I think that we just need to work together as a nation. We kind of just need to unify ourselves. You know, Donald Trump is still attacking a lot of Democrats and liberals, and, you know, he was saying that first the liberal governors were the ones that were being hit the hardest by coronavirus, and now he's saying that the liberal governors are the ones that are aren't controlling the protests. I think that we need to stop pointing fingers and blaming each other, and that goes on both sides. I think the Democrats need to stop necessarily saying that everything is Donald Trump's fault. I think that we, at this time, we just need to come together, and we need to unify, and we need to drop the ideals, we need to drop the agendas, and we just need to try to work together as a nation. Thoughts, Rune?
That's the way forward, Damien. The way forward is having healthy conversations with other people and to really, really spark debate for a good way forward, and not something that's completely radically left and radically right, but it's a centrist approach. That's how our nation can succeed, because it's going to take every single American to make our nation the greatest it can be. And divulging from that topic, I wanted to mention on the topic of unity, you know, a lot of Republican appointed ambassadors to the UN have been making a lot of moves to bring the United States back into the WHO, because Trump announced at his Rose Garden speech the other day how the U.S. will be withdrawing from the WHO, the World Health Organization. And it wasn't even, you know, clear to Ambassador Bremberg, who's the U.S.'s point of contact between the WHO and our administration, that he was going to do that. Which is absolutely insane, and I think it goes to show how little communication there is between the administration. I want to gauge your thoughts on Bremberg, and I'm reading this today. He was going back to the WHO and talking to their president and saying, what are the steps that we should take to reintroduce you to the U.S. and to appease Trump in that manner? What does it say about our unity in the administration?
You know, it's interesting that you kind of have this lack of communication within the administration itself. You know, I think it has a lot to say, the fact that, you know, the person that's kind of supposed to be delegated all these tasks isn't informed of the fact that, you know, hey, you're kind of losing your job here, buddy. You know, it goes furthermore. I think there was a general, if I'm not mistaken, that was only informed that he had lost his job as a general after Donald Trump made a tweet, and the tweet was forwarded to him. What are your thoughts on that? What's your response to that?
I think it shows that other nations, we are vulnerable, Damien, because the U.S. was getting calls from nations like London, India, and Australia, and things like that, and they were saying, you know, what's going on? Why is the U.S. leaving the WHO? Because if you see, Damien, $500 million are given to the WHO by the U.S. every single year, and we're their biggest donor every single year annually. Having no communication between, first of all, our administration, and second of all, the world, what's going on and why we're making these moves is catastrophic to stopping global crises.
Yeah, well, I think that Donald Trump decided to leave the WHO, if I remember his the speech in which he did leave it, was because of the fact that we're their biggest donator and that China wasn't donating nearly as much as us. If I'm not mistaken, he said that China was donating $47 million in comparison to the United States. I think it was $400 million is what he said at the press conference, or $500 million if I'm not mistaken. It's interesting because I don't think that necessarily you should punish the WHO for that. I think you should go to the Chinese leaders and say, hey, we don't think that it's fair that you guys are causing these pandemics, because it's not. And in certain respect, they are causing the pandemics by having faulty regulation of meat markets, of open-air meat markets and different things, and not informing the WHO that this could be a real threat. In certain regard, the Chinese party is to blame, and the whole country of China is to blame, and I don't think that we should take that out on the WHO, who's done their best to resolve the situation, and who in certain circumstances we've ignored for a lack of better terms. I think that this conversation was one that needed to be had with the leader of these different nations, and not in an aggressive manner. I think we should have just tried to talk to them and talk about the fact that we're donating so-and-so amount to the WHO, and that they're only donating so-and-so amount.
Yeah, we had this conversation, Damien. Actually, we had a bunch of U.S. advisors to the WHO formulating a plan to kind of get China to be on Trump's side and the WHO to be more favorable to Trump by putting regulations on China through the WHO. So we were in the works of creating that plan. All of a sudden, Trump shifts the rhetoric from race relations to, you know, leaving the WHO, which I think partly was because of China and partly because, my personal opinion, Trump wanted to shift the rhetoric towards that instead of race relations in the U.S. But talking about the long-term effect, if we did end up leaving the WHO, which we haven't left it yet, you know, we're not going to be able to be a global leader on situations like health and safety and not coordinate to get vaccines for things like the coronavirus. For example, you know, the WHO was responsible for creating a vaccine for the Ebola virus because every nation was in a coordinated effort. Losing their biggest donor would be catastrophic.
Yeah.
WHO, and for the safety of the world, for that matter.
Yeah, well, on the topic of Donald Trump and the disapproval that we kind of have with his whole move with the WHO and how he's dealing with the administration, two interesting statistics came out today. One saying that Donald Trump's approval rating was 38%, and another one saying that I think it was 67% of Joe Biden voters are a vote against Trump as opposed to a vote for Joe Biden, if you understand what I'm saying here.
Wow. You know what? It shows how our people are not given a choice. I'm saying they're given a choice between Trump and Joe Biden. And the reason why they're voting for Biden is simply to get away from the Trump administration. No, and it says a lot about how Americans are kind of perceiving how Trump is handling things. On that note, I think the re-election campaign for Donald Trump is going to be very, very tough. One major reason, and you and I were talking about this earlier today, the fact that there were released statistics today that showed that Trump administration had been experiencing a recession, the beginning of a recession, ever since February, instead of our perceived date of like late March, which really says that the coronavirus is not fully to blame for our recession. Our administration is. Thoughts on that, Damien?
Yeah, no, it was crazy because, you know, you always had Donald Trump saying that he has the greatest economy, and then you had liberals saying, well, yeah, you have the greatest economy thanks to Barack Obama because, you know, he got out of the recession, and the stats that were being shown were the expectations, or the stats were following the expectations that Obama had left once he was out of office. You know, everything was intact. The numbers weren't higher. The numbers weren't lower. It was exactly as we expected at the beginning of 2016, as Obama would leave office. So it's very interesting to see that his claim to be the number one economy, to have the best economy in however many years, he would claim he'd always flex the economy. It's interesting to see the fact that the coronavirus outbreak wasn't the one that necessarily pushed his economy away, that we were in a recession before we decided to shut down. It's interesting. Once again, it goes against what he had said in January. And you have to wonder why, you know, what percent did coronavirus really play into that? And what percent was it his own doing? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a valid question to have as Americans. How much was his tax cuts, his trade policy and things like that? And how much was the coronavirus? We saw big, big, big improvements in the economy under Trump earlier. And I feel like it was bound to happen. You know, we're bound to see a decrease because the activities that he was doing, in my opinion, were unstable. But the essential question that I have for you, Damien, and for all of our viewers, is will the recession that we're going through right now, as the NBER classified it as a recession today, affect Trump's re-election campaign?
Well, you see, I have had this theory ever since we did an episode a couple podcasts ago, where I mentioned the fact that the 2016 election was the choice between, you know, lesser evils. It was deemed that. It was the decision between lesser evils. And I think, you know, as the stat came out, 67% of Joe Biden supporters are only voting for Joe to get rid of Trump. I want to know what the stat was for Trump back in 2016. What percentage of his voters were just voting for him because they hated Hillary? It's very interesting to think about it. I don't know what the stat is. I don't know if there even is a stat for that. But you have to wonder, did Trump only win for the projection or the reason that people are saying that Joe's going to win now because of the fact that they don't want the other option? What do you think?
You know what? I think it's a valid question that we need to have as Americans. You know, what was the reason why Trump won in 2016? Because it was an upset win. We thought Hillary was going to win by huge margins, and Trump won, I think, because of a lot of people's discontent. First of all, Hillary. Second of all, her kind of actions she was doing. She was under investigation, as we say, by James Comey at the end of her campaign. And second of all, Hillary was slacking off, per se. She was not pursuing key swing states because she thought that she had them in her grasp. In terms of reelection, the economic status that we've had as Americans, you got to mention the fact that Obama won reelection with a 15% unemployment rate out of the recession. But the reason he did so was because he was able to kind of push the blame from him, you know, maybe to Bush instead of himself. Can Trump push that blame to somebody else?
I don't think it's going to be somebody else. I think it's going to be something else. I think that he's going to stick on the fact that the coronavirus was really the thing that did it. And if numbers, I think that Donald Trump has a chance because, you know, a lot of people are saying that Trump, where was I going with this? A lot of people, I really lost my train of thought here. Just continue on. I completely lost my train of thought. I pulled a Joe Biden.
That's very funny. That's very funny. That was interesting. But, you know, we're going on to some more points to talk about today. We'll switch on to another topic because we have 10 more minutes in our podcast section for today. We saw a very interesting thing by Ben Shapiro today, Damian. And yes. Ben Shapiro said a very interesting thing about sports. Mm-hmm. Want to talk about that?
Yeah, so basically he said that there should be a different sports league where the players just shut up and play the sport and not talk about politics. That's not his words. Those are my spin on his words, just to be corrected. But that's basically what he was saying. He was saying that that the fact that players kneel or the fact that players do this and that in terms of politics, that it takes away from the sport and it's ruined his enjoyment of sports in America.
Yeah, quote unquote, he said, you know, sports are his place of comfort, you know, but that place of comfort has been removed from him because sports leagues integrate politics that, quote unquote, impede play. I think, referring to Ben Shapiro, I think that actions like Colin Kaepernick's and LeBron James's over the years have not been to impede play, simply to voice their opinions because, like us, you know what I mean? They're people. Mm-hmm. And they're allowed to have a stance on things like these, and I think there is no reason that they should be able to have that free speech and that stance on these because it enhances sports.
Yeah, I mean, I was a big time Ben Shapiro fan, like a huge time Ben Shapiro fan, I think that he brings up great points sometimes, but obviously, again, being central minded, sometimes I can strongly disagree with what he's saying, and I think that this is one of those times where I'm going to disagree. I think that if you have a platform to voice your opinion, that it's right to do so, and I think that this should go for not only liberals. I think that it's a very hard place for conservatives in Hollywood, in sports, in different areas to voice their opinions without being canceled by this cancel culture that we're now undertaking. So what are your thoughts?
I think, Damian, that we should uphold our freedom of speech wherever we are. We should encourage healthy discussions within Americans and not just bash people having conversations. Like, you and I were, you know, having healthy conversations about how Drew Brees' rhetoric has not been best over the past couple of weeks, which he has apologized for, to the dismay of Donald Trump. He did apologize for that. But anyways, we're having these conversations about rhetoric. We're not condemning it. What we're saying is we don't agree with it.
Yeah,
And instead
exactly.
of condemning it, we should talk about it and say, here's why I don't agree with it. Here's why I do agree with it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it is unhealthy to just tell the other person to shut up. And I think that that's what we're doing with this podcast. We're doing the opposite of that, rather. We're trying to invoke a conversation. And I think that it should be a conversation that's being had in the locker room in team sports. It should be a conversation that's being had in public. I think that we should listen to what Drew Brees said and not attack him for it. And we should listen to what Colin Kaepernick has to say and not attack him for it. And that at the end of the day, we should appreciate the fact that they are athletes, but we should also not discount their voice. I was, like I said, in a sense, did agree with what Drew Brees was saying the first time around, where he was saying, in his opinion, that you shouldn't kneel for the national anthem, and that's okay. And I disagree with it because of the fact that that you have these people with Confederate flags that are driving on their pickup trucks, and they have the Confederate flag and the American flag on the other side, and I think that that's a greater disrespect to the United States than kneeling for the national anthem peacefully and still maintaining your respects for those who have fought for our nation. I disagree with it on that standpoint, but I don't think that we should cancel Drew Brees because of his first statement, and I don't think that Colin Kaepernick deserved to have been canceled because of his statement. I don't think that it's fair on either side. I think that artists, athletes, anyone in general should really just have the platform to be able to talk, and that we should just listen to them, and that's the way that change is going to get made. I don't think anyone should be attacking anyone else. You can call that liberal, you can call that weak-minded, but if you really want to have a conversation and if you really want to create change, then you have to just make the conversation and not an argument and not try to cancel. I completely disagree with cancel culture. In certain regards, I think there's times where it's needed, but I think that we're kind of devaluing the fact that we have this power to cancel people when we're just canceling them for every little thing that they do. I think people are entitled to have their opinion, and we need to respect it as Americans.
Have to agree, Damien. And talking about opinions, talking about the First Amendment rights that we have as Americans, I wanted to kind of lay light to something you mentioned to me earlier today, and that is the movement that's growing on Twitter and things like that to cancel or to make the KKK a terrorist organization under the U.S. standards. And we're looking at, you know, organizations, Damien, like Antifa. Mm-hmm. And Trump promised on Twitter earlier this week to make Antifa a nationally recognized terrorist organization. And we're having the FBI look at the Antifa movement very, very closely. So why aren't we looking at the KKK group that closely and not classifying the KKK as a terrorist organization?
I think that if we're doing this in terms of tit for tat, that it's a bad thing. I think that we shouldn't just cry and go, oh, you're going to ban Antifa, you're going to say that they're a terrorist organization, then we're going to do that with the KKK. I think that that's the completely wrong approach for people that are doing it with that mindset. I think that the KKK should have been a terrorist organization 100 years ago. You know, I think that this is late, that it's long overdue. I think that both Antifa and the KKK should be deemed terrorist organization in their own respects. But it's ridiculous that that the KKK hasn't been deemed one, if Antifa is going to be deemed one, in, from what I'm aware, in their short history, or at least in their short relevant history. The KKK has traumatized African Americans, and not just African Americans. You know, that's the big moral, the big whoop, is that they hate African Americans. They hate Jewish people. They hate Catholics, regardless of the color of their skin. And they've, you know, now they're wearing Nazi flags on their uniforms. It's just disgusting. It needs to be done.
I have to disagree with you. The point that Antifa should be characterized as a terrorist organization, because the amount of violence that Antifa has showed, I mean, is nothing compared to the amount of violence that police officers have showed in high-stakes cities, gassing people, throwing flash bombs. It's completely unnecessary, in my opinion, and the amount of violence that Antifa has shown back has been very, very, very low. And on that point, Antifa has received no funding. On a central scale, it's a very, very kind of segmented and fragmented group that doesn't have a central structure. So how do you feel about that?
I completely disagree. Antifa should be deemed a terrorist organization, and I'm going to tell you why. A terrorist organization is defined, in simpler terms, as a organization that uses fear in order to create a, in order to spread their political agenda. And that's what Antifa does, whether it's merely their presence that creates fear or it's them killing someone. And that's what the KKK has done. They've spread their political message by burning crosses outside of the houses of members of the LGBTQ community in recent years, and obviously for the past 140 years, outside of the houses of African Americans, Protestants, Jews, Catholics, Jews, and anyone who does not agree with their agenda. So I think both are terrorist groups, regardless of whether you're going to compare them to police. I could say that police shouldn't be deemed bad in that case because cancer kills more people than police do. So I think that it's fair that Antifa is deemed a terrorist group because of the fact that they're using fear to spread their agenda. What's your rebuttal?
I disagree with you on that point because Antifa, and obviously we're over an hour into our podcast, need to wrap this up, but Antifa, it has not been spreading violence in the way the KKK has. And the violence that it has spread, Damien, is not killing people. No, it is looting places, and that's what they have been kind of pushing forward. And we've talked about looting and rioting in many, many instances as a different approach than protests. And they haven't been killing people, but they have been destroying property. And that's the reason why Trump has been trying to label them as a terrorist organization. I think that an act of terrorism is very different than a terrorist organization, because some people in Antifa have been committing acts of terrorism, say, but the organization itself stands for much more. And it stands for anti-fascism. And the policies that the organization itself has are not to promote, not racism, but violence. They are to promote anti-fascism in its entirety, but a few members of them, like the police department, have been promoting, you know, terrorism.
Again, I think that then in a general statement, if it's a difficult subject, I'm not too informed on Antifa, but from what I've seen, they definitely have been using fear to spread their political agenda, or at least they've been categorized as using fear. I think that in that case, it wouldn't necessarily be fair to say that if Antifa isn't deemed a terrorist organization, in some regards, the KKK shouldn't necessarily be deemed one, because beyond the fact that a couple of their members do negative things such as cross burnings, they do the neo-Nazi gatherings that we saw, you know, in Charleston, and unfortunately that led to some casualties there done by a neo-Nazi and a KKK member. And I think that it's not fair necessarily to deem one a terrorist organization if you're going to do it on the fact of exceptions. I think that it needs to be something that's looked at, and I think that it needs to be something that's decided. I think that the KKK, however, without question, needs to be deemed a terrorist organization. Antifa, it's something that I want to look at, and I definitely want to bring it up on the next podcast. Speaking of the next podcast, we are going into about an hour and 2 minutes now of our live broadcast. Next episode on Wednesday, we are planning on bringing Will, who is a moderate conservative. He considers himself a Republican, but considers himself a moderate Republican. What do you have to say, Brun?
Yeah, so Will's coming on our podcast. He's going to be kind of giving us a different point of view on many topics and giving us healthy conversation and debate, which, as Damien and I mentioned earlier, is the way to go forward in our nation. Having these kinds of healthy conversations between centrists, left-wing people, and right-wing people, it's the way to go forward. We're excited to have Will on next week, and hopefully other candidates on as we go forward as a podcast. Once again, we would like to encourage you to follow our Twitter at Politatine Show, and to, you know, contact us via there or our email at politatinepodcast@gmail.com. If you would like to, you know, ask us any questions about ourselves, our podcast, or how to get on, or to join our team. So once again, thank you so much from our hearts for joining our podcast today. About defunding the police and many, many, many initiatives in terms of these race relations topics across America. And we look forward to joining you guys back on Wednesday.
Yeah, we definitely do. We encourage you guys to go and have a healthy conversation of your own, to create a conversation about politics in the United States of America. But beyond that, we want to thank you guys for tuning in, and we hope that you guys do have a great rest of your Monday night and a great day if you're tuning in the morning. You can check us out on Spotify at Politatine. But beyond that, again, we're signing off. Thank you. Alrighty.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for watching today's episode of Politatine Podcast, our fourth installment. And as always, make sure to follow our Twitter at Politatine Show. And if you want to email us at politatinepodcast@gmail.com with any updates, questions, or feedback for Damien and I about our podcast. And as always, thank you so much for viewing our podcast and for showing your support for the Politatine Initiative. Make sure to sign our petition at change.org/justiceinfoco to show your support for our initiatives thereafter. And stay tuned for Wednesday's episode involving a conservative moderator named Will Carroll. So thank you so much, guys.